Have you ever wondered what it would be like to be thrust into a deadly game of succession where gods are enslaved and your own grandfather wants you dead? N.K. Jemisin's groundbreaking debut novel, The 100,000 Kingdoms, explores exactly this scenario through the eyes of Yin Dar, a barbarian chieftain summoned to the floating palace of Sky. The novel, which won the Locus Award for Best First Novel and was nominated for the Hugo, Nebula, and World Fantasy Awards, revolutionized fantasy literature with its unique narrative voice and complex exploration of power dynamics. Beloved by readers worldwide, including celebrities like LeVar Burton, who praised its mind-bending originality, this first installment of the Inheritance trilogy has become a cornerstone of modern fantasy, particularly celebrated for centering non-white characters and challenging traditional power structures in both its storytelling and its world. I am not as I once was. They have broken me open and torn out my heart. With these haunting words, Yin Dar begins her tale, one that starts with a summons from her estranged grandfather to Karta Aramiri, the most powerful man in the world. At 19, Yin is the chieftain of her matriarchal Dare tribe in the High North, a position she's held since her mother Kinneth's mysterious death a month earlier. Though she has her mother's dark skin and her father's green eyes, she's never known her mother's family, the Aramiri, who rule the world from their floating palace called Sky. Upon arriving at the magnificent palace after a three-month journey, Yin is shocked when Dakarta acknowledges her as his blood and names her as his heir, alongside her cousins Samina and Relad. What initially seems like recognition is quickly revealed as a death sentence. "Your mother deprived me of an heir when she left our family," Dakarta tells her coldly. "You will pay her debt." The Aramiri rule through a combination of wealth, political manipulation, and most importantly, their control of the gods. Four gods who opposed Atempus in the Ancient Gods War are kept as slaves in Sky, bound by magic to obey the Aramiri's every command. These Enifedae, as they're called, are living weapons used to enforce the family's will throughout the 100,000 kingdoms. As Yin navigates the deadly politics of Sky, she quickly realizes that her grandfather has no intention of letting her live. The succession contest between the three heirs will end with only one survivor. And as a half-breed outsider with no allies, Yin's chances seem non-existent. Her only hope lies in understanding why her mother abandoned this place of power and privilege, and whether the enslaved gods might offer her a way to survive. There were once three gods. The one who matters killed one of the ones who didn't and cast the other into a hellish prison. On her very first night in Sky, Yin encounters the most dangerous of the enslaved gods, Nahadath, the Night Lord, oldest of all gods and embodiment of chaos and darkness. When Simina unleashes him to hunt Yin through Sky's corridors, Yin flees in terror until a strange boy helps her hide. This child reveals himself as Si, the trickster god, who appears as a perpetual child despite being ancient beyond human comprehension. Si leads her to safety through hidden passages, showing her magical toys that are actually miniature worlds with storms and clouds swirling on their surfaces. When Nahadath finds them, Yin instinctively stabs him to protect Si, an act that should result in her immediate death. Instead, Nahadath looks at her with wonder and says, "I have waited so long for you," before collapsing. A massive gray-clothed woman named Jacarn appears, explaining that Nahadath wouldn't have killed Si. Jacarn returns Yin's knife, transformed into a finer weapon, and Yin realizes these beings are more than just slaves. They're a family with complex relationships spanning millennia. The gods mark Yin with an invisible sigil that makes her appear bound like other Aramiri while protecting her from magical control. Though they threaten to kill her if she reveals their secret, Yin sense their desperation. They need something from her, something they could take by force, but prefer she give willingly. As Yin learns more about the Enafade, she discovers their tragic history. Once, three gods ruled the universe in harmony: Nahadath, darkness and change; Itempus, light and order; and Enafa, twilight and life. When Itempus killed Enafa and imprisoned Nahadath and their godly children, he remade the world in his image, a world of rigid order where only he is worshipped. The enslaved gods have endured centuries of humiliation and pain, forced to commit atrocities at their master's whims while wearing the faces of the hated Aramari. What makes this portrayal of gods so compelling is their humanity. They experience jealousy, love, rage, and despair despite their immortal nature. Nahadath shifts between his terrifying nighttime form and his subdued daytime self, called Naha, who appears more human but is cold and calculating. Si craves maternal affection, playing childish games while harboring ancient wisdom. Through these complex characters, Jemison explores how power and imprisonment can transform even divine beings. My mother deprived me of an heir when she left our family. You will pay her debt. As Yin navigates Sky's treacherous politics, she searches for clues about her mother's past. Why did Kinneth abandon her privileged position as an Aramari heiress to marry a barbarian nobleman? And was her death truly an accident, or was it murder orchestrated by the family she left behind? Yin's investigations lead her to Viraine, the palace scrivener, magician, who claims to have been her mother's friend. He warns her about the dangers of the Enafada, explaining they must respond to any imperative statement she makes, however figurative. Even casual phrases like, "to the hells with you," could be interpreted literally as commands to take someone there. This magical compulsion is part of their punishment. They cannot refuse a direct order from an Aramari. When Yin questions why Dakarta brought her to Sky, Viraine doesn't deny her accusation that Dakarta had her mother assassinated. Examining her mother's body in her memories, Yin realizes the mark on her mother's forehead, where her Aramari sigil had been, was the entry point for poison. Yin also meets her rivals, Semina, a sadistic woman who delights in using the gods as torture instruments, and Relad, her alcoholic brother who seems to have already given up the succession contest. Neither seems interested in alliance with Yin, viewing her as either a threat or irrelevant. Through dreams and visions, Yin experiences memories not her own, glimpses of the ancient gods' war and the catastrophic aftermath when entire continents were destroyed. She witnesses an Aramari lord named Hawker unleashing Nahadath on enemies, only to watch in horror as the Night Lord transforms into a black star that devours everything, soldiers, land, even the nearby capital where Hawker's family lived. Only sunrise stops Nahadath's rampage, but the continent itself breaks apart and sinks into the sea. These visions hint at something strange happening to Yin, something beyond the political machinations surrounding her. When she discovers a marble statue of Enafoth that bears her own face, she begins to suspect a terrible truth about her own identity. My sister's favorite weapon is love. If you love anyone, anything, beware. With only days before the succession ceremony that will likely end in her death, Yin desperately seeks allies. The enslaved gods offer a potential partnership, though their motives remain unclear. Si delivers their message. They want something she possesses that they could take by force, but prefer she give willingly. Though intrigued by this potential alliance, Yin maintains her diplomatic composure, telling Si she'll consider their request. Meanwhile, Yin learns that Semina has been orchestrating a war against her homeland of Dar. Using her political influence, Semina has built an alliance of neighboring kingdoms preparing to attack the matriarchal nation. This threat to her people forces Yin to act, even knowing it might accelerate her own demise. In a bold move, Yeen asks Nahadoth to help her threaten Minister Gemd of Menshaif, the nation leading the alliance against Dar. Though Nahadoth warns her authority ends beyond Sky without Dakarta's permission, he agrees to help her bluff. Using the Night Lord's terrifying power, Yeen transforms two men into enormous diamond statues as a warning. She secures Gem's promise to withdraw from the alliance, though he warns other nations may continue their aggression. This action draws Samina's wrath. In retaliation, she tortures Si in Sky's arena, somehow aging him and preventing his godly healing. When Yeen intervenes, Samina reveals she knows about Yeen's interference with the alliance against Dar. As sunset arrives, Nahadoth appears in a blast of bitter cold, freeing Si. But when Samina commands him to kneel, he complies, shocking Yeen. Under artificial sunlight, Nahadoth transforms horrifically as his nighttime form gives way to his daytime self, revealing the original violation, Itempas brutally forcing Nahadoth into human form. Unexpectedly, Relad approaches Yeen with his own proposal. Though he initially dismissed her as useless, he offers to help Dar by hiring mercenaries to attack Menche's capital, forcing half of Dar's enemies to turn back. This would give her people a fighting chance with manageable odds. Though suspicious, Yeen accepts his offer, forming a tenuous alliance with her alcoholic cousin. As the succession ceremony approaches, Yeen begins to understand the true nature of Aramiri power and the terrible price of becoming family head. The chosen heir must convince their most cherished person to willingly die on their behalf, using the Stone of Earth to transfer the Master Sigil. With multiple heirs, they compete to force the sacrifice to choose one of them. To have me is to die. Amid the deadly politics and divine machinations, Yeen finds herself drawn to the Night Lord. Unlike his daytime self, who is cold and calculating, the nighttime Nahadoth is passionate and wild, dangerous yet compelling. During their encounters, Yeen senses his loneliness and rage at centuries of imprisonment, but also glimpses the magnificent being he once was. When Yeen asks why he didn't kill her when they first met, Nahadoth reveals he sees something of Anifa in her. Their connection deepens when he shows her the truth about her mother's past. Kinneth discovered Dakarta killed her mother during his succession, then sought the Enifidae's help to escape her blood sigil. They suggested getting disowned and aimed her toward Yeen's father. In a moment of vulnerability after learning these truths, Yeen offers herself to Nahadoth, asking if he would kill her if she requested it. He agrees, understanding her desire to control her death as she cannot control her life. But Yeen clarifies she's not asking to die, she's asking for him, despite his warning that to have him is to die. When she speaks the ritual words, "Do with me as you please, Night Lord," he takes her beyond human experience, through cosmic realms and toward the maelstrom itself, in a union so powerful it destroys her bedroom. This relationship forms the emotional core of the novel, exploring how love can exist even in the most desperate circumstances. For Nahadoth, Yeen represents both a reminder of his lost love, Enifa, and something entirely new, a mortal who sees him as more than a weapon or monster. For Yeen, facing certain death, Nahadoth offers both comfort and agency in a situation where she has been stripped of all control. Their relationship is complicated by the revelation that Nahadoth once loved both his divine siblings, Impasis as well as Anifa. The three gods had been lovers before jealousy and betrayal tore them apart, suggesting that the cosmic conflict that reshaped the world began as a divine love triangle. This adds layers to Nahadoth's interest in Yeen, raising questions about whether he sees her as herself or merely as a vessel for Anifa's returning soul. You have two souls, yours and hers. As the succession ceremony approaches, Yeen finally learns the full truth of her existence. During a fever-induced delirium, she experiences a vision about the three gods as siblings, one wild and dark, one bright and stern, and a little girl who grows into a woman who creates life itself. When she awakens, Jacquarn explains that Yin carries two souls, her own and Anephis. The goddess's soul has influenced Yin's appearance, making her resemble Anepha. When Yin desperately asks if they can remove Anepha's soul, Jacquarn warns her her body has grown accustomed to two souls and might not survive with only one again. Si reveals the truth behind this arrangement, Yin's mother's bargain with the Anephidae. In exchange for curing Yin's father of the walking death, a disease that compels victims to walk until they die, Kinneth allowed them to use her unborn child, Yin, as a vessel for Anepha's soul. When Intompus killed Anepha, he kept a piece of her, the Stone of Earth, which preserved all life in the universe but also trapped her soul in this world. Without a body, her soul drifted and eroded over centuries until the Anephidae found it. They needed to house it in flesh to restore it, and an Aramaic child offered poetic justice. The stone is the key to the gods' freedom. It subdues them, trapping them in flesh and binding them to the Aramaic. Only Anepha's children, godlings or mortals, can wield her power. The Anephidae plan to use Yin during the succession ceremony. Because she possesses Anepha's soul, she can wield the stone's power uniquely, enough to set them free before she dies. This revelation forces Yin to confront difficult truths about her mother, who essentially sold her to the gods, though Yin acknowledges she might have made the same desperate choice to save someone she loved. It also explains Dakarta's true purpose in bringing her to Sky, not to win the succession contest, but to facilitate the transfer of power between him and either Relod or Simina using the Stone of Earth.
I am not as I once was. On the night of the ball celebrating Yain's elevation to air, she dances with Nahadoth under the moonless sky, finding unexpected joy despite knowing it's her last night alive. At dawn, she summoned with the other heirs to the succession ritual at the spire's top, a circular glass room sacred to Itempus. The unimpressive Stone of Earth floats above the oubliette shaft, but Yain briefly sees its true form, a perfect silver seed. As the sun crests the horizon, the stone blossoms into a gray light that makes her dizzy. When Dakarta commands her to name her choice, she chooses Relad, shocking Samina. As Yain reaches for the stone, Varane whispers, "I'm sorry," and stabs her through the chest. Though her body lies dead on the floor, Yain's consciousness remains, watching as Nahadoth confronts Itempus, who has appeared in his true divine form. Their tense exchange reveals Itempus's plan to destroy Anepha's legacy completely. As the gods clash violently, Yain communes with Anepha's essence, learning that she must take her place. The stone enters her body, healing her wound, and she returns to life transformed. When she opens her eyes, she sees colors she never knew existed and senses the world with new perception. She instinctively tears away the chains binding the Anephidae, freeing them, especially Nahadoth, who transforms gloriously into his true form. Though filled with Anepha's power, she chooses to remain Yain rather than letting the goddess's personality overwhelm her own. Confronting Itempus, who threatens to destroy her again, Yain explains that as the goddess of life and death, she can never truly be destroyed. Some part of her will always remain to bring her back. Together with Nahadoth, she sentences Itempus to punishment. He must live as a mortal, serving all humanity rather than a single family, able to use his powers only in great need and only to help mortals. His sentence can end only when he learns to love truly.
Yaine's rebirth as a goddess brings profound changes to existence itself. She transforms Sky with a gigantic tree that pierces the heavens, its roots nestling the city between their forks. This physical manifestation of her power symbolizes the new order she establishes, one where the gods are no longer slaves and the Aramiri no longer hold absolute power. With her divine authority, Yaine makes several significant decisions that reshape the world. She frees Nahado's daytime self as a separate being, giving Naha the chance to live his own life. She reunites with Si, who joyfully accepts her despite her not being exactly a Nefa. And she executes Kuru for her betrayal. The goddess had been secretly working with the Tempest all along. For the mortals, Yaine's actions create both opportunity and challenge. She tells Dakarta that without gods to enforce their will, the Aramiri must rely on wealth, armies, and their own viciousness to maintain power. She suggests Tweveril as his heir, recognizing his competence as he already organizes an evacuation amid the chaos of Sky's transformation. When Dakarta accepts her recommendation, Yaine heals his hip and stabilizes his heart, giving him enough time to oversee the transition. This act of mercy, helping the man who orchestrated her death, demonstrates her new divine perspective that transcends human grudges. The novel ends with Yaine embracing her new existence as one of the three. Nahadoth kisses her tenderly, promising to show her wonders, and they pass beyond the universe together. Yet even as she leaves mortality behind, Yaine maintains her identity and values, suggesting that divinity doesn't erase humanity, but rather expands it. Through this conclusion, Jemison offers a powerful message about cycles of power and oppression. The gods who were once enslaved are now free, but they choose not to exact widespread vengeance on humanity. Instead, they establish a new balance that allows for both divine and mortal agency. The Aramiri, who ruled through cruelty and the exploitation of enslaved gods, must now learn to rule through more conventional means, or, perhaps, give way to more just systems. The 100,000 Kingdoms masterfully explores themes of power, identity, and transformation through its unique blend of political intrigue and divine mythology. Yin's journey from mortal pawn to goddess represents the ultimate empowerment narrative, yet the novel never simplifies this transformation as purely triumphant. Instead, it examines the costs of power and the complexity of identity when faced with literal divinity. The transformation comes with profound sacrifices, the loss of simple human pleasures, the weight of immortal responsibility, and the burden of knowing too much about the nature of existence itself. What makes Jemison's work so compelling is how she humanizes gods while simultaneously exploring the divine potential within mortals. Nahadoth, Si, and the other Enafade are not distant, perfect beings, but complex individuals shaped by love, trauma, and millennia of experience. Their imprisonment has changed them, just as Yin's divine soul has influenced her throughout her life without her knowledge. Nahadoth's darkness contains both destruction and creation, while Si's eternal childhood masks ancient wisdom and deep wounds. These gods laugh, cry, rage, and love, their emotions perhaps even more intense than those of mortals because they feel them across the scope of centuries. The novel also offers a nuanced examination of legacy and inheritance. Yin inherits not just her mother's Aramiri blood and her father's Dare heritage, but ultimately Enifa's divine essence as well. This triple inheritance creates unique tensions and possibilities, forcing her to reconcile vastly different worldviews and power structures. Rather than choosing one identity over others, she integrates these aspects into a new whole, becoming neither fully Enifa reborn nor remaining simply Yin, but something unprecedented. Her transformation suggests that identity is not a zero-sum game, but a continuous process of integration and growth. Through this story of gods and mortals, Jemison challenges readers to consider how power structures perpetuate themselves and how even divine beings can be imprisoned by systems of control. The Aramiri's enslavement of gods serves as a powerful metaphor for how institutions can corrupt absolute power, turning tools of oppression against both the mighty and the weak. She suggests that true freedom comes not just from breaking chains, but from reimagining the relationships between the powerful and the powerless, creating new possibilities that transcend cycles of oppression and revenge. As Yin steps into her divine role while maintaining her human compassion, she offers a vision of power tempered by empathy and justice, a revolutionary concept in both the world of the novel and our own. Her synthesis of mortal and divine perspectives creates a new paradigm for wielding power responsibly, suggesting that true strength lies not in domination, but in understanding, not in isolation, but in connection. The legacy she creates is one that honors both her divine nature and her human experiences, proving that transformation doesn't require the abandonment of one's original self, but rather its elevation to something greater.